Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're about to join us for This Week in Law, where we are joined by Bebe Chui, co-founder of Atrium LTS. Atrium helps us gaze into the crystal ball to see what legal services look like for tech companies or what Atrium wants them to. In any event, we have a fascinating discussion with her where we get to meet Justin Kahn, of all people, as well. Mike Keyes and Matt Curtis are also with me. And once we say goodbye to Bebe, we talk about weaponizing Pokemon Go, Levi swinging again at protecting their tab, and Nebraska lawyers accepting payment in Bitcoin. More on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, Matt Curtis, and Emery Roan. Episode 403, recorded October 13th, 2017. Flying car law and tuna-free toys. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited that you've joined us this week for episode 403. We have a very special guest this week who we're dying to chat with, and she is Bebe Chui. She is the co-founder of Atrium LTS, which is doing very, very interesting things for the legal field for tech companies. Welcome, Bebe. It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great.
Bebe's also an author. She's written a book called The Lawyers of Modern China. And this is not her first time founding a company. She also founded Attorney Fee, which was then acquired by LegalZoom, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And how long of a process was that?
Oh, it was a very long process. The We encounter LegalZoom actually during one of these shows. I was on some show discussion about changes in law, and then it happened to be that the general counsel of LegalZoom was one of the other guests. And we chatted afterwards, and he's like, you know what? I really think we should acquire your company. And from that statement to closing took like 3 years.
Well, that is great. Very cool. Yeah. Well, I don't think any of us is going to acquire Atrium LTS, but one or more of us might want to come work there. So bear that in mind. And I'll introduce the rest of our panel as well, so everyone knows who may be working with Bebe. Matt Curtis is the most likely culprit. He's in law school at Notre Dame. Hi, Matt. Great to see you.
Thanks for looking out for my job prospects, Denise. I always appreciate that. good to be back, and good to be on the show. So thank you, everybody.
And Mike Keyes, who's a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Matt. Hi, Bebe. Great to be with all of you today.
Great to have you all here. So I was explaining to Bebe before the show how we're a technology law show and not a legal technology show. But in her particular case, and with what she and Justin Kahn and their enterprises are up to, it's a good crossover here, because not only are they building out legal technology for use by the legal field, but they are building out a whole business model, which they hope will be the way that tech does law. So as I understand it, there are a couple
very
of components.
Meta.
Yes, very meta. A couple of components to this. There's a law firm called Atrium that is a very novelly conceived law firm, of which Bebe is co-founder. And then there is also this component, the LTS component, which stands for what, Bebe?
Legal Technology Services.
Logically enough. Yes. Which is the whole back end, coming at things from the standpoint of, we're going to provide very streamlined legal services, and we'll talk about what that means in a minute. And the way we're going to do that is by providing technology that allows for delivery of very streamlined legal services. So there are two parts to this, and there is venture funding involved. I love the whole concept of starting a law firm and letting investors get you off the ground. Tell us about your whole journey with Atrium LTS, Bebe.
Yeah, so as Denise said before, LegalZoom acquired my first company, and I was doing marketing there, and 2 years later, my earnout ended, and I, was on my way to Mexico, super excited, packed my bags, everything, and then ran into Justin Kahn. So Justin's like, you know what? I'm a power user of, venture law legal services, and I don't understand why it can't be done in a modern, way, right? And he's like, I don't understand. I want to start this company. So
before you go further, let me just jump in there and say we have a very tech savvy, geeky audience who probably all know who Justin Kahn is. But for anybody who does not, can you explain?
Oh, yeah. He's the most unlikely character for starting a law firm. Top line. Right. And the reason why is because he started Justin.TV. That's his claim to fame, which eventually pivoted into Twitch that sold to Amazon. But in addition, he is a partner. He was a partner at Y Combinator prior to Atrium, and personally invested in, over 130 companies that are all doing great things. So he's like very influential in the Valley. Definitely, more in media, in video. He started live casting before anyone, here. And it's just like a very like media focused person. So he's like quite a celebrity in the scene.
I met Justin a long time ago at On Hollywood, an event where people come and speak about and learn about the intersection of technology and Hollywood and law and policy. And he was there. He had just started Justin.TV, and he had his helmet on where he was capturing everything. So somewhere I am in Justin's archives along with thousands of others. But yes, fascinating, fascinating person.
Yeah. It's very fascinating. For example, we've been getting all of our engineering candidates from his Snapchat. That's a legit recruiting channel at Atrium.
Got it.
Yes.
So when my husband comes down on my kid for using Snapchat, I will be able to say, no, this is important to his future.
That's exactly right.
You want him on there. All right, good. So you and Justin get together. Justin is the least likely person to start a law firm, but a huge consumer of legal services. And he's necessarily happy with how those services have been delivered. And what did you guys decide to do?
It's actually super funny. He's like, I exited for, nearly $1 billion, and no one took me out to drinks to thank me from the law firm.
Oh.
He's like, so you would think that, someone would take me out and then just have some client service involved, right? Like, he asked everyone, he's like, do you guys have a CRM? Like, do you even know what's happening in my company? Like, do you know what's happening in my life? And they're like, what's a CRM, right? And that's when he's like, wow, there's actually a huge opportunity here. Law firms are among one of the most profitable businesses out there, actually. After figuring all the profits and everything, the profit margins are very high. It's much more of an archaic service that still operates on the billable hour. So a lot of things are wrong with it. Huge market opportunity. Corporate legal, accounts for $400 billion of spend, right? And it's like 2% of GDP. So he was like, wow, I'm going to start a company in this area. Recruited myself. It was just very serendipitous. And then also we convinced a partner at Oric to move his practice over. Like he was a high-performing partner with book of business of startups, and we decided let's start as a venture law firm that helps startups with their legal services. And the reason why we chose that is because we are tech savvy, right? And we want the lawyers in venture are among the most tech savvy because they serve startup clients, and startups clients are naturally savvy. And so it's just a really good fit for figuring out whether we can create a law firm that runs better on technology stack.
Right. And one thing we should give people, since we have a lot of listeners who are lawyers, but a lot who are not. And, as far as I know, what you may not realize if you've never used a lawyer before, if you've never hired a law firm before, is the way that law firms traditionally have worked is all about something called the billable hour. And this is accounting for time, you know, like various other professions. I think marketing professionals, accounting professionals do the same thing, where they put a dollar value on the amount of time spent and you log it all. And when it comes time for bills to go out, the amount of time that has been spent getting your project done or whatever work toward the completion of the project done becomes a line item on the bill. And so you're paying for the time that people have spent. And lots of law firms have recognized that from the client side, that is suboptimal in many ways, because it's unless you've had some sort of discussion with your client about, okay, we're going to charge you by the billable hour, but we're going to put some sort of cap on that. We're going to give you at least an estimate so we know what you're going to wind up spending. The costs can get out of control, and the hourly rates for the lawyers involved. I've been practicing law since 1990, and I thought the hourly rates were high then when I came out of law school, and they've done nothing but go up from there. And there are lawyers in our country, and I'm sure around the world, who with a straight face will charge you $1,000 or more per hour for their time. That's certainly not the rule. That's the exception, but they're out there. And, more commonly, you're going to be charged several hundred dollars an hour for a lawyer's time. And again, lots of folks consider that suboptimal. So firms have struggled with, okay, how can we give our clients what they want, more certainty in cost? And the way you guys are doing that, Bebe, is by identifying what startups need and giving them, okay, we're for this chunk of your equation, it's going to cost this much, right? You're giving them flat rate fees.
That's right. That's right.
So that changes the economics of the law firm a bit. And I have a lot of questions for you about that I want to get to in a moment. But first, before we go there, can you tell us more about the tech side of all of this? How you're hacking the stack, if you will, that lawyers use because I know one of your clients or partners or somehow you're affiliated with the folks doing, oh my God, now I'm blanking on the name. The legal AI. Who am I thinking of here?
I have Ross. Are you thinking
Ross? Yes, Ross Intelligence.
Oh,
yes.
Ross Intelligence. That's one of our clients. They just announced their funding round, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Ross Intelligence. Correct. So right now,
and Andrew Aruda, founder.
Yes,
he's been on the show.
That's right. He's great. So here's how we look at it. My first company was a legal tech company. But it's no matter how sexy legal tech gets, even with AI or smart contracts or whatever, all the buzzwords, you need to find a, firm, right? Like there's still at the end of the day needs to be licensed lawyers who deliver the work, under their licenses. There needs to be lawyers who, use those technology. And that's really why Atrium got started, was because there's all this great technology out there, but the lawyers are not incentivized to use that technology because of the billable hour. Now, since we changed the incentive structure to a flat fee, structure, then we're incentivized to be efficient and we're incentivized to use all sorts of technology that is out there. And if we don't find a technology, piece of technology that we like, we develop our own. And that is why LTS is really the, technology engine behind driving products that once developed will be immediately used by a cadre of really highly talented lawyers. And so that is what Atrium is. That's what LTS is. And particular technology we are working on right now is, you know, it sounds simple, but we do deals here. So we want to do all the startups deals, right? Like Series A, Series B, lots of interesting documents, rich with private ownership data. Very great. And then so from that data, it's like, how do we, you know, map out everyone's ownership, you know, in the company, in the future. And so we just have so much rich information to work with. And one of the first projects we're doing is just like, how do we get rid of the concept of a document? You know, I think that before the internet age, like all legal documents are, you know, words have to be printed on paper. There's four corners, all of that. And people think of law as just like templates or documents, but really that's not the basic unit, right? The basic unit is information. It's getting the result done as a result of delivering pieces of information. So we're really taking all of this information and then, you know, just restructuring it so that there is no document involved. We can, you know, free flow, either just spin it into a SaaS or updating cap tables, you know, generating Performa calculations and whatnot, like without having attachments go back and forth. So we're SaaSifying a lot of that information.
That's great. So, I mean, it sounds like you're going far beyond merely electronically signing the kinds of documents that lawyers would otherwise generate.
Yeah, that's right. So traditionally in a deal, there's 1,000 emails going back and forth between everybody with attachments to like spreadsheets of this calculation. And then someone's like, I don't think this looks right. And then you send another spreadsheet, you know, there's no versioning. There's no, nothing like that. Like imagine, you know, in coding, there's no GitHub, right? Repository. Mm-hmm. And then you're just writing code on Word doc and like transmitting it back and forth, you know, that's really the analogy. And you're like, no, I changed this line. Like it's this and that, right? And so really what we're doing here is in the back, you know, recognizing all the inefficiencies that that creates and then like turning that into a platform.
So on the LTS side, is it your thought that law firms like Mike's, for example, would come to you and say, hey, we really like what you're doing. We'd like to be more efficient too, and we're going to license your technology?
That is a question that is far beyond our current experimentation. So currently we're just trying to prove that we can do, we can create software for a venture practice. You know, so software needed for other practice may not apply. Like it may be very, very different, but right now we're focused on venture. And if we do well, we hope to convince other law firms practicing in other areas that we can help them in that way as well.
All right. I've been asking all the questions, and I know that Matt and Mike have lots of questions too. So, Mike, what do you want to know from Bebe?
Yeah, Bebe, it sounds super interesting. It sounds like Atrium, though, is more focused, at least right now, on transactional related practice.
That's right.
So there's no litigation services that are provided by Atrium. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah.
Is there a thought that you may want to try to get into the litigation space, or do you envision this primarily being focused on transactional venture startups, that sort of thing?
To start, definitely more transactional. I think Legal Innovation has, you know, done pretty well in the litigation space in that like there's all sorts of, you know, e-discovery and whatnot. And it'd be really interesting to get into that, of course, way down the line. There's so much rich data there, you know, and really what you want to do is marry the two, like the transactional and the litigation, the whole life cycle, right? But it is very different mentality, different practice, different talent, different technology. So we don't envision going into that for a very long time.
And that's sort of where Ross Intelligence, sorry to jump back in, where Ross Intelligence and Andrew Arruda come in because they're developing software that can replace various practice functions within a law firm. They have a whole, although as he puts it, they're not looking to put people out of work. They're looking to make them more efficient, make their jobs make more sense, have some of the work done by the AI, and their first target was bankruptcy, and they're looking to move out from there. So it's interesting that you guys are working with them. It seems like at some point what they're doing could get incorporated into your LTS side.
Yeah, currently we're not working with them. We are their lawyer. We are their law firm that closed their financing. So their financing was performed by us. Yeah. But yeah, in the future, exactly. We don't necessarily take a stance that we always use our internal technology. We very much conduct a builder by analysis. You know, and to the extent that there is a piecemeal piece of technology that we can use, we would love to use it.
Great. Matt, I'm sorry, were you chiming in there?
No, but the question that I would like to ask is how are you defining success in your venture, and what are like the key metrics from the technology side that you guys are trying to hit for integrating into the law firms?
Yeah, the technology metrics there are two types of metrics. One is efficiency, right? Like technology is supposed to make the lawyers work more efficiently. So the contribution margin is a metric. And then the second metric would be client happiness. You know, we have these like automated weekly reports that we already send out to clients, where it's really simple, actually. It's just like, as lawyers work, instead of billing, like we already productized the flow to the point of generating, you know, weekly updates and telling people like what has been worked on, what is being worked on, what ought to be worked on, you know. And even that, it boosted client. They're like, wow, no other law firm has done that. Like, this is so helpful. Thank you. Right. And we measure NPS as well. So NPS is what companies do. They measure from 1 to 10 how happy the client is at any given point. We are a completely client-driven firm. So we measure NPS every month. And so that's another metric that technology is subservient to. We need to make the firm more efficient and make our clients happy.
Sound like great goals. I'm curious, back to the venture aspect, the fact you guys launched at TechCrunch Disrupt, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. On stage.
Right. So couldn't be more front and center Silicon Valley. You've raised venture funding of your own in addition to helping your clients raise venture funding. Does the venture funding, how does that get allocated? Is that to the law firm or to the tech side or to both?
Yeah, very good question. So the venture capital goes into LTS. It's our the engineering department. So that is the part that receives the venture funding and will continue to receive the venture funding. And yeah, working in this business is so meta all the time. Like, we closed 96 investments, you know, into our A round. And we used our own, we developed our own closing tool to do that. And, you know, to instill confidence into our investors that, you know, we're developing this, right? Like, as we go. So it's really fun. Yeah.
Right. Eating the dog food, as it's called. You're using your own product.
That's exactly right.
Love it.
We did like a one-click closing tool, because usually there's a lot of administrative, like signature package, you know, assembly that would take paralegals and junior associates hours and hours and hours to do, and rack up the bill to be, you know, six figures. So it's this way, like, we, you know, did a one click, like everyone signed, everyone generated signature packages, boom, right? Just to give you an example of the type of things we do on a daily basis.
Right. So I explained a little bit earlier about billable hours and the conventional way that clients are billed and the fact you guys aren't doing that. So are billable hours logged by the firm at all? Is that even a thing for Atrium?
Not a thing. We don't want our lawyers to focus on doing accounting. If you think about the billable hour, it's literally like bad planning because you don't have an accountant, right? Like accounting for what you ought to do, project what you ought to do, account for what you did. So that the lawyer is doing their own accounting every 6 minutes. Instead, if you productize everything, you have a catalog, then when the lawyers do work as projects, as discrete things, then the business can plan and it can like account for their work products.
Right. You were showing us before we started recording where your office and how it looks. It doesn't look like any law firm I've been in before. Can you give us the virtual tour?
Yeah, we'll give you. For sure. Okay, so I'm in one of the conference rooms. I'm going to show you guys. Sorry about the shakiness. We just moved in here. So there's like whiteboards everywhere, right? And then this is an office where we are all sitting together. Like all the lawyers are sitting in pods. So this is where... Guys, don't be on Facebook. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so, you're live. Okay, so... Anyway, so we sit in pods. This is like what we call the atrium council sign. So this is our, all of the attorneys here are from Fenwick or from like Gunderson, and we are, the startup's first general counsel. So that's that. And then this is the intake department where, we also have a lot of virtual paralegals, but there's, paralegals working on just like collecting documents and organizing them. On a full-time basis. And then this is our deals team who does all the wonderful deals that, to help our clients, raise money and whatnot. So, and it's like pretty much panoramic office. We have the entire floor. Outside there's you can't see the smoke, but,
but yeah.
Yeah. So, which is,
there we go.
Yeah, but there is Soma. A lot of smoke, but this is exactly Soma, which is the heart of, where all the startups are in San Francisco. And most interestingly, we, even though we encounter this space, right? Like we discovered that it overlooks, do you see where it says Sixth Sense here?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that was Justin TV's old, first office where it started.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
And I wish we can zoom in, but it looks like a mess. And we were just constantly reminding ourselves, this is where, Justin started. And look at him now, and we work hard.
That's right. Your colleagues should be used to you wandering around with a camera while they're working, because if Justin were there, that's sort of an occupational hazard.
I'm on brand right now. Okay, let's go find Justin, actually. This is going to be really fun. this is so meta. Justin! Justin! Hi, we're on a live podcast where there's a lot of audience. But this is Justin, and... How does it feel to be on the recipient of, someone else holding the camera?
Hi, Justin. I was telling Bebe, years ago, I met you at On Hollywood, and I was an early person you put on Justin TV. So
yeah.
We're turning the camera back on you.
Yeah, we're turning the camera back. It's so funny. So hilarious. Anyway, so... Yeah, exciting stuff. We hope to, fill this office up very soon with every venture lawyer in the city.
Very
we counted neat. About a couple hundred, and this space fits that. So.
Awesome. Tell me about the space. You're leasing it, correct?
Correct.
It looks like
I'm sorry.
A co-working space.
No, this is dedicated. We really are serious about building this out. So
what? Back years ago, the first firm that I worked for, I became a partner in that firm. And one of the things that I didn't know about being a partner, an equity partner in a law firm at the time, I was still pretty green out of law school, was that in addition to the pros of, you get to say you're a partner and it sounds very prestigious, you're also expected to do things like personally guarantee the lease. So I'm wondering...
Yes.
How you guys have organized the firm? Is it a traditional partnership structure?
Yeah.
How's that work?
So the firm, Augie and I are founding partners, right? And what we have done is that everyone who joins, we decided not to have titles, which is why if you look at our team page, we don't have like, okay, this is associate or senior associate. It just doesn't really matter. They're all legal. We're all legal professionals. And most importantly, each of us working at Atrium has equity in LTS. So we're incentivized to, so we're all equity partners in that way, that we all are in a startup together. We own equity. We own a piece of the company. So it's, there's no like individual book. It's just everyone's incentivized to, you know, do really good, well, and that gets distributed, you know, like a high growth startup company. And the basis of the equity is that we're all consulting in a way, in the way we work, you know, the processes and software that is going to be created.
Very cool. And so people have equity in the LTS side. And I assume your compensation is salary based on the law firm side?
That is right. And we pay the cravat scale. So we, because we really do want to prove that, you know, we can run a top tier law firm. So we pay, every lawyer, what they are paid, you know, elsewhere, because we believe we can make the business model work.
And for people outside the legal field, what Bebe just said means that they are paying top scale salaries in the legal field for a cravat Swain, if that's still their name, is a New York law firm that pays their people quite a bit.
Like there's the Google pay scale, which is like the hallmark of that. So in law, we call it cravat scale because there's like this top firm in New York that sets the pay scale. And every year, whenever they set it, like every other firm kind of follows, or the prestigious firms follow. So we do follow that scale.
Great. So you're charging less. You're paying a lot to your folks to keep them happy too.
Yeah.
Goodness. I think that was
her startup, you know.
Yeah.
We know how to spend. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Mike, what else do you want to know from Bebe?
So is everything done, Bebe, on like a flat fee structure? The clients come in and they know exactly what the charge is going to be for a certain task, or is there any?
Yeah, very good question. Very good question. So we have two what we call product lines. So one is the SaaSified legal plan, right? So a startup that scales. So what that means is a monthly plan for Atrium Counsel. So every client comes in as an Atrium Counsel client, paying us monthly, and their usage, we would charge them by usage. You know, it's like if they, we correlate the factors, like if you have X number of employees, X number of documents, and in a regulated industry, this is like the monthly fee for you, right? And it's it introduces a lot of predictability into their legal budget. So the people pay what, you know, what is typically that stage of company can afford. And it scales from there as they add more employees and whatnot. And then the other side is as projects come up, so that covers like the basic general corporate advising and whatnot. And as projects arise, you know, so certain people want a trademark, right, or a copyright, or you know, a privacy policy package, a term of use. Like their clients have increased, and they really need to. That's a high risk item now. So those we carve out as projects, and we do those for flat fee as a flat fee project.
That's fantastic. Since I'm translating for the legalese to the people on the tech side, I guess I should translate the tech ease for the people on the legal side who may not know what you meant by SaaSified, but SaaS is software as a service. Yes. And can you break that down for us? How are you translating that concept to your legal services?
Yeah, so a SaaS plan in the startup world, right, or in any software world, you really correlate usage with a fair price to pay, and the burden is on the business to find a correlation that exists between people's employee count or cap table count and the amount of work generated. So you know, we traditionally software goes through this business model. But now we're seeing a lot of professional services take on this business model as well. So there is, off the top of my head, accounting services like Bench, right? So Bench is a SaaS professional service as well, where as your business scales, your bookkeeping and accounting scales with it. And the team, you know, is allocates more bandwidth to you as you grow. And we take the same approach here.
So it sounds like what you've done is you said you had a bunch of former Gunderson people there. Mm-hmm. What was the other big firm that you mentioned?
Wilson Sonsini.
Yeah, Wilson Sonsini people there.
Auric, right.
Right. So these are law firms that are known for doing a lot of work for Silicon Valley clients. And it sounds like you've brought in people. It sounds like at various levels of seniority, yes, from those firms.
Yes, mostly more senior, because what we want is to automate more away the paralegal and junior associates, right? And we want to free up the lawyers who are highly trained to advise and mm-hmm. develop relationship with the clients, you know, visit their office because they're all right here and mm-hmm. Really understand their business. And so that's the type of thing we want to empower the more senior attorneys to do.
Take them for drinks when they close their round.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And on the, you know, law side, which is really interesting, because we sit at the heart of the Valley, we encounter the newest, you know, technologies, right? So we get ICO requests all the time. And our attorneys are thinking, like, how do we build a ICO practice? Mm-hmm. You know, and so we're at the forefront of those types of discussions where technology and law truly do intersect. And, mm-hmm. We have lab automation. So right now the buzzwords are ICOs. Everyone's doing ICO. Mm-hmm. So and then there's like automation is another one, right? Like lots of automation, AI, smart contracts. We're exploring that. And it's just very cool that, you know, because we're at the cutting edge, a lot of the lawyers have the opportunity to mark a territory for developing their practice on products that may not exist, you know, in maturity, right? So one lawyer, it's so funny, we're looking at his LinkedIn and he's like, yeah, I'm the expert on flying car law. Mm-hmm. What is that, you know? Sorry, dropped my headphones. And that's definitely an area that's going to emerge for sure. So it is, we sit at a very cool intersection here.
It's very cool. And it, you know, the things that you're checking off as things you do are things we talk about on this show every week. So we're fascinated in how you're approaching, practicing that kind of law in a new way. And I'm sure you must have just huge amounts of enthusiasm from the people you've brought over from these other firms, because what happens when lawyers go and they're working in a more traditional law firm setting where the firm's been around for decades, the firm tends to be a little established. They do things a certain way. And when you're the lawyer who has to work within those parameters, you're butting up against, gee, yeah, I know that's how we've always done it, but it could be done differently. And why don't we try this new thing? But sometimes the law firm says, yeah, that sounds good, but we're not going to do that right now. Now they get to try out all the great ideas they've had over the years.
Yeah, exactly. And I really want to thank Justin, because with his involvement, it makes doing this a lot sexier and, you know, lot more fun, because traditionally, legal tech and law has only attracted like sort of the conservative, personality types. And here with Justin's involvement, you know, Ashton Kutcher wanted to invest, right? And, mm-hmm. Lots of like, you know, Incubus's lead guitarist, like now is doing a tech company and becoming our client. So like it really does bring law, the practice of law closer to what's happening in the forefront, you know, like of tech, of Hollywood and whatnot. And we're really excited to be finally bridging that gap.
It's super cool. We're very glad you have had the opportunity to be able to chat with you. We know you're busy and probably have much you need to run and take care of. I'm going to go around and just make sure I haven't missed anything that Mike or Matt wanted to cover. Mike, any final thoughts or questions for Bebe?
Oh, just one final question. You mentioned, you know, you have several big law expats, you know, some big names, Wilson Sonsini in particular. I know almost firsthand the number of hours that folks at a firm like that typically work. Do your lawyers work the same amount as they were at their big law counterparts, or are they able to be more efficient or otherwise work fewer hours as a result of the switch?
That's right. They absolutely do work fewer hours. Because we give people project goals, right? We're like, you need to complete 2 financings a month, right? And then on your own accord, like if however you want to manage that, that's fine, but we're not sitting there counting minutes. And so that frees people up to just like, you know, own their work in a way that they haven't been able to.
Right. And I think we were talking about this before we started recording, and we should probably just, it sort of goes with what you're talking about now. And that is, it looks like you've got, you know, as you said, big space, room for lots more lawyers there. But I was curious about how virtually people can or will work as well, whether time in the office is something that's going to be important to Atrium going forward.
Yeah, right now it is, because we are consulting on our engineering team, giving them live feedback on the software that they're developing. So that is the most important reason for everyone to be in the office, is because we are developing and trying software all together. You know, it's almost like people need to drive a self-driving car, right? Like around town. They can't just be absent. Like, you have to train it and whatnot. So that's why we're all here. It's like a lab type atmosphere. But eventually, once a lot of the software efficiencies are developed, like our knowledge repository, you know, like a GitHub, like, you know, internal thing, and a beautiful, like, SaaS, like, you know, external facing thing, then everyone can work from wherever, really.
Sounds great. Matt, anything final you want to add or ask?
Yeah, so part of the sell to clients is the predictability of cost. Have you nailed down like an average cost of each of these services and tried to benchmark that, or how are you approaching the cost structure?
Yeah, we're approaching the cost structure. So we pay our lawyers the same as the other firms, right? And then we build in profit margin goals that we need. So we back into the price that way. And that is, it's a cost-led model rather than a, what you're thinking of is a comp-based model, because there is no comp really. So.
Right. And I guess my final question has to do with just how open and transparent you've been with us today. And, you know, as you said, Justin is recruiting people off Snapchat. speak for a moment before we let you go about, your firm and your lawyer's approach toward talking to people who aren't within the firm and who aren't their clients.
What do you mean? Just like,
social media, podcasts, journalists, you know, sometimes call up a lawyer in a firm or a senior partner at a traditional firm and start asking all kinds of probing questions about how the firm works, they'll hang up on you immediately. And you haven't done that with us here today, and we're very grateful for that.
I'm just
curious whether you've thought about, you know, your outward facing. Do your lawyers have their own Twitter accounts and they tweet about, they would, of course, because we're ethically barred from sharing client confidences or, you know, tanking a client's goals by letting people know what they're doing strategically. But do they, you know, are they fairly public in their online footprint, for example?
Right now, we're developing that, and we take client confidentiality very seriously, because, you know, deals can be called off if things get leaked, right? So we take that extremely seriously. We're trying to develop and adhere to policies that protect our clients first. And on that foundation, we will obviously promote our lawyers and, you know, give them tools to promote themselves. In many ways. And I do love how, like, being here, we are, you know, we try so many products. Like, it's really interesting. We have all these other our clients' swag laying around, you know, like, the other weekend we had, distributed this, like, little hangover cure that a client developed, right? Mm-hmm. And called 82 Proof. It's actually from LA and it was amazing. So yeah, so we were like, we talk to our clients all the time and whatnot, but while respecting their, what goes on legally. So.
Wonderful. I think that's a great approach. And it's been so great chatting with you, meeting you here today, Bebe. We're honored that you've taken the time to join us and we're thrilled to learn about what you're doing. We wish you all the success.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Super fun. And thanks for, you know, having me on the show. Everyone reach out to questions. Atrium.co is the website. Just fill out a form, get back to you. And finally, enjoy the rest of the episode.
Thank you so much. We hope to talk to you again sometime.
Okay, thanks, baby.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Take care.
Take care.
Well, that was fun. Thank you so much, Matt, for reaching out to her and getting her on the show. I had read about them while TechCrunch Disrupt was going on. Justin Kahn was interviewed there when they launched and thought it was just a fascinating thing they were doing. And I still think so. What do you guys think?
I think it is, too. I applaud them for being, thinking outside of the box. I think it's terrific.
It is. And there's so much going on that, you know, will impact the legal field. I think Atrium is a great example of people, you know, she was saying before the show how she had been talking to someone from her alma mater and who was hitting her up for a donation. And she said she was then followed up with the question, should I go to law school? And she said, no, don't go to law school, which I tend to tell people a lot too, because, you know, if you go the traditional route, it can be a little soul crushing, but they're not going the traditional route. And I think it sounds pretty exciting and can be very, very rewarding to all concerned. Do you agree, Matt?
Yeah, I think it's great. I think that from the client perspective, what you're looking at is, you know, you're building a web of knowledge to use for the future. So, you know, that they have programmers in the same room as attorneys, I think that's a really good mix. And in terms of product design for this kind of niche field is a really good thing. I also think that, like, just, you know, something that it seems like any practice could incorporate is just a basic CRM where you're keeping in touch with your clients. Seems like that's a major pain point that they're feeling as well, which is not something that's not new technology. There's plenty of services that offer that. So in terms of competing with them, that's something that seems like should be done.
Yep, absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for indulging our interest in the practice of law for a little while at the top of the show. I think it's a good fit for us though, because they're really skewing their practice directly at the technology industry and trying to disrupt how that industry receives a vital part of its legal services. And I'm sure, you know, down the road, they'll want to expand beyond just the venture side of things. So one to watch there. Also, I'm so excited that we get to watch Pokemon Go again this week. It's been a long time since we've talked about it. But the Russians have given us a reason to talk about it this week. And I wasn't quite sure where to drop this story under the various topics that we try and cover. Where I dropped it was under trademark, and we'll tell you why in a moment. So this was a late addition to the rundown for this week, but I thought it was just way too fascinating not to cover. I think this just broke yesterday. And if you haven't caught wind of it yet, various social media platforms have been called out, Facebook and others, for having been essentially gamed by firms or a firm working on behalf of the Russian government to try and sow the seeds of chaos in the United States around the election or just in general. And CNN had an exclusive report yesterday of a Russian-linked campaign called Don't Shoot Us that is right in line with the various things you've been reading about Facebook ads purchased to sway public opinion during the election. This is kind of the same thing, except for it involved Pokemon Go, which I think is just amazing. Niantic has been fast to come out and say, hey, we want to be clear. We weren't hacked. Nobody played around with the game or got into the game or manipulated the game. What apparently happened here is there was a campaign by a firm who is thought to be working on behalf of the Russian government. They have a Tumblr page they were operating. That Tumblr page is still up, but Tumblr won't confirm. It's now moved on to a different subject matter. But at the time, it purported to be an activist in the Black Lives Matter movement. And they started a campaign called Don't Shoot Us. What CNN has reported is that it was likely run by a Russian / Moscow linked troll farm called Internet Research Agency. And what they did was they took some screenshots of Pokemon Go, and they were attempting to say, to tell players who were visiting their Tumblr page because it purported to be part of the Black Lives Matter movement, hey, let's go to places where there have been officer-involved shootings, controversial shootings, and play the game there. And then name your things, your Pokemon, I guess, captured in the game after, and how sad is this? I mean, this is just so disrespectful, but after people who were shot and killed, and bring awareness to the issue further through your use of Pokemon Go. And Niantic, the reason I slotted this in under trademark, and I guess we can talk about copyright too, is what Niantic told CNN was, our game assets were appropriated and misused in promotions by third parties without our permission. And then they go on to note, and they want people to know, as a platform, Pokemon Go was not and cannot be used to share information between users in the app. So our platform was in no way being used. This quote-unquote contest required people to take screenshots from their phone and share over social networks, not within our game. Niantic will consider our response as we learn more, the company said. So, Mike, how long before they sue for infringement?
Yeah, I mean, it does raise an interesting question. I mean, I would imagine that this activity would have been at least a violation of the terms of service for the Pokemon Go application. And maybe there are some trademark and copyright related claims there. I think we do need a little bit more information. But what really struck me about this story is the degree of sophistication here with the meddling. I mean, this shows, you know, that people, whoever was involved and behind this, was really into and knew a lot about what was happening here in our society, and was, you know, trying to really take advantage of the situation here. So this is really troubling, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely. And I hadn't heard of other Tumblr pages being used in this way, but it certainly makes sense that it would be. So add Tumblr to the list of companies who may have or appear here to have been manipulated on behalf of the Russian government, in ways that are designed to cause turmoil here in the U.S. Matt, what do you think of all this?
I was buried a little bit in work this morning, so I didn't get a chance to read the article.
Oh, so you didn't see me at it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But I would agree with Mike that this is what it shows is a, you know, if this is true, that this is the Russians, what it shows is that they're very adept at looking at pain points within our culture, and also, you know, looking at, you know, video games for as a means to exploit them. So I agree that it's troubling.
Right. Kind of brilliant. I think Candy Crush was also implicated as a thing that they were using in a similar way. So it wasn't just Pokemon Go, but God knows we love talking about Pokemon Go and the legal ramifications of using the game. I guess the takeaway is, if you're seeing a campaign to use a video game in an activist kind of way, that you should think twice about, you know, it's probably not at all sponsored by the game maker, and maybe sponsored by someone who is trying to manipulate your behavior. Anything else to add on this, Mike?
Nothing from my perspective.
No. All right. Pikachu, we hardly knew ya. a few weeks ago, Mike, I don't know if you've had the chance to look at this or not, but Victor in the studio pointed out an interesting trademark dispute involving Bumblebee Tuna and DC Comics, aka the Transformers franchise. Have you been following this at all?
This is the one involving the the Hasbro DC Comics dispute.
Yes.
That was recently filed in the Southern District. Yes, I did hear about it. I did read the complaint. Interesting issue there.
Did I throw tuna in there and tuna's just not involved at all?
maybe that's in the amended complaint that I haven't read.
There's no tuna in this dispute.
I think that's the name of our
show. No tuna whatsoever. All right, so we've got Bumblebee in the DC Comics world, aka Transformers, and some sort of toy doll made by Hasbro that are going on. DC Superhero right. Girls, Mattel's Bumblebee toy. So help enlighten me. I'm obviously just brushing the surface of this.
So yeah. Hasbro is on
Thank
the
you,
Transformers
Victor.
Bumblebee, and then the uh-huh. the doll, she's actually a character from DC Comics, and like kind of a more recent one, like in like the Justice League or Teen Titans books. So she's more on like the teenage teams and stuff, but their line of like girls dolls.
Got it.
And I may or may not have a daughter that was interested in those.
It's okay, you can cop to it. fighting about Bumblebee, can it be far or far away or a long way before tuna throws its hat into the ring? It's all about the tuna. All right, well, so there's a dispute. Anything more we need to know about this?
So I guess one of the interesting wrinkles here, at least based on what I read, you know, Hasbro is claiming that it has a federal registration for Bumblebee, which it does, with respect to a Transformer toy. That's what it's registered for. Now, DC Comics, of course, has the Bumblebee character. And as I understand it, this DC Comics character predates the actual Bumblebee Hasbro toy. DC Comics, I think it appeared back in the 1970s in some sort of DC Comics franchise publication of some sort. So I think there's an interesting issue as to priority here. But it sounds like what Hasbro's really upset about is that more recently, DC Comics has started to merchandise its Bumblebee character in the form of a toy. And that, I think, is what is making Hasbro upset. So it does raise an interesting issue from a trademark perspective in terms of who's got priority here. Bumblebee, the Hasbro Bumblebee, was first in time as far as a toy character is concerned. But DC Comics appears to have been using the Bumblebee character in various print publications going back to the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Matt, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I just think it's interesting as these characters are drawn out longer and longer, and they have ebbs and flow of popularity, especially with, you know, movies being a dominant tool to get these toys to market, that it really depends on what, you know, when the movie came out as well as you know, when they're originally printed in terms of their popularity and their viability in the market. I'm not aware enough of the legal ramifications of how that is going to outcome in trademark law. But I do think it's interesting as these, you know, characters are cycled through and become popular and lose their popularity and how that all plays out.
Yeah, Mike, does it matter that the name involved here is something that comes up in lots of contexts, like tuna? that a bumblebee is a fairly generic thing as opposed to something that was made up just to be the name of a toy?
Right. It's a really good question because mm-hmm. as I understand it from looking at the Hasbro toy itself, that is a bumblebee, right? It's mm-hmm. a form of bumblebee. And so they've got a registration for a toy, but the toy happens to be a bumblebee, at mm-hmm. least this particular incarnation that they're trying to protect. So I think it raises the issue as what is the scope of protection here? Can they really claim that they have the exclusive right to use bumblebee associated with a toy that is actually a bumblebee?
Right.
That would clearly be a generic use of the term. A bumblebee is a bumblebee. and therefore you can't really claim trademark rights associated with that, or so goes the argument.
Right. We don't have Optimus Primes floating around from flower to flower in the world.
That's a very sad thing.
But we do have the, I know, wouldn't it be nice if we did? but we do have the bees. All right. I think we've destroyed that. Let's put an MCLE passphrase into the show before we do our last couple of trademark stories. We put these passphrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional who likes to watch or listen to our show for professional credit in your field. If you are a lawyer, you can apply to receive continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction and see how that goes. Actually, some jurisdictions you can't apply. We have tried to provide you some guidance along those lines at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. And if you're a lawyer, we hope that we've pointed you toward at least some of the forms that might be helpful for this. And we put these phrases in because some jurisdictions want to know that you actually watched or listened to the show and that you can prove that somehow. So our first phrase is going to be Pod Bay Offices. I think that's thanks to Virgil in chat. Thank you, Virgil. Harkening back to our discussion with Bay Bay. And should we talk about jeans next or... your article at the TMCA, Mike, what are you most in the mood for? We'll do them both.
Great. Let's go to jeans.
Let's talk about Levi's and the fact that Levi is now coming after Vineyard Vines, another clothing manufacturer, in federal court in Northern California. And this is not about a specific Levi logo or anything that says Levi or even stitching on a pocket that looks like Levi's. It's about the tab, the little red tab on the back pocket of the jeans. Apparently Vineyard Vines has a tab too. And Levi's doesn't like that. Can you trademark a tab, Mike?
Well, yes and no. You can certainly have trademark protection with respect to your particular source identifying tab. The red Levi's tab that Levi's is very protective of. They clearly have trademark rights associated with that tab. But what Levi's has done and what they have done for decades is engaged in a campaign to essentially – rid the marketplace of any denim product, any pants product that has a tab that's anywhere near the pocket. So they have a very expansive view of their trademarks. And, you know, they have a reputation for being the 800-pound gorilla in the marketplace when it comes to trademark enforcement. I mean, they've sued countless companies over that tab and have sued countless companies over the back pocket stitching, the arcuate stitching, and also the little leather patch on the back. Kind of their three trademarks. They're very, very litigious and, you got to hand it to them in one sense. They've had great success in getting people to roll over. Not all companies have done so in the past, I might add, but they have had some pretty good success. But they have very, very expansive views of their trademarks.
Right. So the photo featured at the Fashion Law blog where I saw this written up has a navy blue tab on the Levi's with the Levi's name and logo on the tab. And then Vineyard Vines uses a whale, a little sideways whale. On the other side, it though too is also navy blue. Does the color matter here?
I mean, the color matters, the placement matters, the type of product itself matters, where it's sold. I mean, are consumers really going to be confused? Levi's thinks any tab on any denim product is going to cause confusion. I just don't buy it. Yeah. You know, to a large extent, though, companies have looked at the cease and desist letters and or complaints that have been filed, at least in this case, and they look at it and they say, you know, it's just not worth it. Do we really want to fight this against Levi's, who has this reputation for taking things to the end of the earth? Do we really want to fight it, or do we want to just say, fine, we'll get rid of the tab? Because it's ultimately, at the end of the day, isn't that important to us, and we'd rather devote our resources to developing our business as opposed to fighting Levi's.
Right. You have had some personal experience with fighting Levi's on behalf of Abercrombie, correct?
Yes, I have.
How did that go?
On behalf of Abercrombie and other clients as well. We had a case where we defended Abercrombie and Fitch related to the Arcuate stitching design. We actually ended up trying the case to a jury there in federal court in San Francisco, and we did receive a defense verdict. So it was one of the only cases that Levi's has ultimately tried with respect to the Arcuate. I think the last time they tried a case was 1957 over the Arcuate stitching design, but they've sued literally hundreds of companies with respect to the Arcuate design. So they, again, that's another one of their trademarks that they're very, very proud and fond of and like to make sure that they rid the marketplace of any other company that's using a stitching design on a back pocket.
This is how we know that you actually spent many a month litigating this case. Arcuate? What the heck is an Arcuate?
That is Levi's fanciful name for that back pocket stitching design. Arcuate. Not an arc, but an Arcuate.
That's wonderful.
I'm really glad you asked.
Go ahead, Matt.
I was just glad that Denise asked because I thought that was something I should have known and didn't. So thank you.
Is that something that's going to impress my wife?
Yes.
I would imagine so.
All right, I'm going to use that.
Don't you know?
Yes, especially if she's a big Levi fan. Yeah, that's the kind of thing you only learn when you've written many a legal brief that has that word peppered throughout it. So, but does it help them in protecting that mark that they've come up with a name for the shape on the back of their pocket?
Oh, not so much. I mean, the name I think is fanciful itself, but I don't think our rank and file consumers in the marketplace know that it's called the Arcuate.
I don't think so.
So, no, I don't think it necessarily helps in their enforcement efforts.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds fancy when you're in trial.
It does sound fancy. All right, go ahead.
Just a quick question. So when we're talking about the ability of a company like Levi's to dissuade other companies from contesting their trademark infringement claims, what kind of cost are we looking at to bringing this to trial?
Oh, it could vary, Matt, but it could be, you know, several hundreds of thousands of dollars, well past $1 million to see a case against Levi's through trial, because I can tell you firsthand, they're very, very aggressive. There's going to be lots of discovery. There's going to be lots of depositions. They're going to contest things by motion practice a lot. And I know their primary law firm very well. They're great, great lawyers, great people. We just have a fundamentally different view of the world when it comes to Levi's trademarks.
Right. And folks who heard me at the top of the show going on about how we're a tech law show might wonder why I bring up things like Levi tabs on jeans in our tech law show. And the reason that I do is that these trademark issues that we talk about in other contexts sometimes definitely carry over into the technology arena and have to do just as much with genes as how websites are designed and logos and things that appear everywhere in the technology world. So that's why sometimes we get into the world of denim. It's a tenuous connection, but understanding the concepts and permutations of trademark law when it comes to back pockets will help you understand them in more technological contexts as well.
It's a nice compliment to our discussion with Bebe, because of course Levi's is based in San Francisco.
Yes,
so there's
it is.
Another connection.
It's they're north of Market, not south of Market, if they haven't moved since the last time I saw their compound there, but still close by. Let's talk about Black and Decker and the way they conducted their consumer survey, which is another thing that is done a lot online. Tell us what happened there, Mike.
Sure. This is a case that was brought by Black & Decker, a trademark infringement, trade dress infringement case against a competitor that was using its trade dress, that Black & Decker well-known trade dress. And I think there were some trademarks associated with that claim as well. Mm-hmm. Black & Decker sued this company. The case ultimately went to trial. Black & Decker received a $54 million verdict as a result of the infringement. Post-trial motions were filed by Black & Decker, and ultimately the trial court granted the motion to set aside the verdict and essentially wiped away the $54 million award that was provided to Black & Decker. I think I misspoke there. The defendant was able to get the court to wipe away $54 million verdict. So it was a case involving ultimately the evidence that was considered by the jury was a consumer survey, which mm-hmm. is very typical in these types of trademark and trade dress infringement cases. And so these consumer surveys, there are certain ways to conduct them and certain ways that you can't conduct them. And I think it's the case is a very good reminder for both counsel and trademark survey experts that you got to make sure that you're following established protocols and norms when you put together these surveys. It can be very costly otherwise.
Yeah. And we're back to bees. This was all about the yellow and black trade dress that was used in the survey.
Absolutely.
So the complaint about the survey was that because it was showing different products that both used yellow and black, that the people taking the survey could have been confused?
And so there were a number of flaws with the survey. So when you're putting together these consumer surveys for any sort of trademark or trade dress case, what you really want to do is you want to the extent you can, to the extent possible, you want to approximate the marketplace conditions. In other words, you want to present consumers, the people that are in your survey, you want to show them the goods as they're going to appear in the marketplace, mm-hmm. right? So if products appear together in the marketplace, the Black & Decker and the Positec mark, if they're sold side by side, well, you can put together a consumer survey that replicates that condition, i.e. shows the consumer or the respondent in the survey the products side by side and ask them certain questions to think if to see if they believe there's an affiliation or connection between the two companies. But if the products aren't sold side by side, then that wouldn't be a proper survey design. And so that was one of the big problems associated with this consumer survey design. The people that were shown the products were shown kind of a mocked up combination of these products being sold side by side, when in fact that apparently doesn't happen in the marketplace. So that was a big problem with the survey. But then I think even more problematic is, not to get too far into the weeds here when it comes to consumer surveys, but you know, consumer surveys in these sorts of cases are testing causality, whether the trademark or trade dress at issue causes confusion. I mean, that's the only reason that you would want a consumer survey to come in, is you use that expert and that expert survey to show that the infringing trade dress or allegedly infringing trade dress causes consumer confusion. And the expert somewhat inexplicably in the testimony said that he wasn't testing causality here. And that's a pretty significant flaw, because if you're not testing causality, what are you testing for? So that was another big problem associated with this particular survey expert's testimony. So ultimately the court said, you know, the survey was really the only evidence of actual confusion in the marketplace. And without it, you know, the jury couldn't have come to the conclusion that it ultimately did.
Fascinating. Thank you for going through that for us. Matt, did you have anything you wanted to add or ask?
No, just I always recommend people read Mike's blogs because they're a mm-hmm. fun read and to dig deep into these concepts. So, but I think he covered it great.
Yes, and Mike blogs at his firm's great blog, which is called thetmca.com, which stands for Trademarks, Copyrights, and Advertising. We went kind of long with Bebe, and everything else that I had in the rundown to discuss is kind of evergreen, and we can discuss, you know, another time. There was one story I wanted to just point out for you two, in case you hadn't seen it, is that, and I think it's funny that a state bar has had to make this clear. I don't know that what the state bar's involvement in this question is exactly, but the state of Nebraska has decided to come out and issue an ethics opinion. Again, I'm not quite sure how ethics are implicated here necessarily, but we can get into that if you'd like. The state of Nebraska has said that lawyers can take payment in Bitcoin. And I suppose if anyone's going to take payment in Bitcoin, we should have asked Bebe if Atrium will. But I'm guessing they might. And that apparently there are enough lawyers out there that want to accept payment in Bitcoin. Heck, why would you not want to accept payment in Bitcoin in these days and ages, in this day and age? But Nebraska has seen fit to come out and say it's okay to do that. We don't have an ethical issue with you doing that. I'm not sure that the method of compensation really implicates a lot of ethics that a state bar needs to weigh in on. What if someone comes to your firm, Mike, and says, I have a herd of goats that I'd like to pay with.
Right.
If Dorsey wants the goats, can't Dorsey take the goats?
I would think so. I have never had a client suggest that they're going to pay their invoice in goats or chickens or potatoes. I would think that it's possible.
Yeah. Apparently, state bars do think that this is worth weighing in on, or at least Nebraska. The article in the ABA Journal points out that Eastern Nebraska is a rapidly growing hub for payment processing and financial technology. Bitcoin ATMs are in use in the area, and the currency is being used on a daily basis there. So it's a hot button issue in Eastern Nebraska. What do you think, Matt? Are they talking about Bitcoin as a form of payment in law school yet?
No, but I haven't taken my ethics class, but I kind of doubt that's going to come up, nor the goat scenario, although that would be wonderful. just talking to lawyers, I've heard lawyers who were certainly working on more personal issues than Mike's dealing with, but they've been offered, you know, sort of like medals and guns and that sort of thing for, I can't fathom why this matters, how you take your payment, but that's that. But it's good that they came out the right way. But I am interested to see whether the rise in Bitcoins in Western Nebraska has anything to do with Western Nebraska's proximity to Colorado and its legalized marijuana. Oh, Eastern.
Eastern Nebraska. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's different. It's not that big a state, right?
It's pretty big.
Okay.
And there's not that much in Western Nebraska.
Gotcha.
According to one of the articles that I was reading on this story, if I've got this correct, I haven't actually read the advisory opinion, but according to one of the sources that I read, it said that the opinion gave the green light to accept payment via Bitcoin, but it needs to be immediately converted to U.S. dollars. Maybe there was some sort mm-hmm. of concern about, given the fluctuation in the market for Bitcoin, maybe lawyers and law firms could take advantage of that somehow. So I don't know. This is pure speculation.
And I'm not way up on whether you can accept things like stock in payment, but that seems to be an equivalent, right? Something that would fluctuate in value. Do you have to immediately sell the stock once you've accepted it as payment? I don't think so, if you're allowed to accept it. So
there's certainly examples of companies that have traded legal fees for equity in their company. I mean,
right.
That doesn't make much sense.
Right. And those goats, you know, they fluctuate a lot in value too.
They do.
The goat market, highly volatile. All right. Well, I just wanted to point that out in case there was anyone who wanted to pay their lawyer in Bitcoin, or any lawyers who want to start taking it, that the bars of the land are starting to consider how that works. And with that, I think we'll just jump into our concluding material for the show. We have another robots are doing this now kind of story. First, we told you that they were molecular. Now they're doing dental surgery. You pointed this out, Matt. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, yikes. So some brave soul in China has decided that they were going to allow a robot to do their dental surgery, and so it is a growing area of, you know, another place where robots are going to take over. You know, the ability for them to process on a nanoparticle level within your mouth is just going to be better than what a dentist can do. So I would imagine that this will reduce the cost of dental surgery down the road. So I think it's really exciting, and maybe about 10 or 15 years when they perfect this, I will be needing some work.
All right. I just, my mind boggles. I'm not sure what the informed consent requirements in China are, but drafting that up for this particular process once they decide to have robotic dental surgery or other kinds of surgery in the United States, that document is going to be a sight to behold. I don't want to be involved in drafting it.
We use robotic surgery in all sorts of procedures.
Right.
But, you know, dental is just something, it just seems different. And I think that's more of a visceral reaction that we have to that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, thank you for highlighting that. We need a second MCLE passphrase for the show. So it's going to be Bitcoin gladly accepted. If you are listening for MCLE credit, you now have both of our phrases for the show. We have a resource of the week that is somewhat in keeping with what Bebe, our guest, was up to. I know for my part, and presumably, Mike, for yours too, it's something I think has been a very long time coming that has been necessary. Bebe's firm does not do litigation, but Mike still does, and I certainly have. And litigation involves filing briefs with courts. And when you file a brief with a court, it is full of citations to legal authorities. And more it is electronically filed with that court and needs to include hyperlinks so that when the court is going through, or whoever's going through and reading it, you click the link and it takes you right to the case that is cited, and not only that, but the page within the case. So you've stated a legal principle, and then what the site does is it takes you right to where you can look up and see, oh, here's a higher court that we have to follow, and this is what they've had to say on the matter. Fastcase is a legal technology company that has come up with something called cloud linking that, as far as I know, didn't exist until now, and they just launched it this month. And it's software that takes your brief full of these sites, and it converts them. It takes the hyperlinks for the sites and inserts them to something that is universal. So when you click that link, it should go out to the web to some publicly available source and link you to what you need to see, to read the brief and understand what's being cited. I haven't used it yet, but I think it's been an incredibly long time coming, because what happens with a lot of briefs is we can file hyperlinked briefs with courts, but they're linking to these proprietary legal services that aren't of any value unless you're a subscriber to those services. What Cloud Linking does is provide a link that anybody can use no matter what they subscribe to. So I think it's a great thing. Super resource if you are in the business of generating and filing legal briefs, to be sure. Mike, have you seen anything like this before?
I have not. I think it's a great service, though.
Mm-hmm. Certainly useful for, you know, folks like us who like to read legal briefs and discuss them or think about them, but might not necessarily be directly involved in the case or have access to the tools necessary to get to those sites from proprietary services. Don't think we didn't bring you an animal selfie of the week. We did. The perennial favorite We Rate Dogs Twitter accounts sometimes brings us selfies. This is one of those times. A doggo they decided to feature seems to be triggering some sort of camera device and taking a cute selfie of itself. We Rate Dogs as well is featuring a lot of dogs in costume as at this time of year. Not many of them are full-fledged animal selfies where the animal is taking the photo. And this dog is not in costume, sadly, but it's very cute. And it is a classic animal selfie of the highest legal order where it appears that the doggy itself is taking the picture. Anything to add to our animal selfie this week, guys?
Nothing here. I think it speaks for itself.
Indeed. Matt?
No, I always cute as always.
Cute as always. All right. Bye, doggo. Have a happy Halloween. And you guys too. How are the holiday preps in your neck of the woods coming along? Halloween a big deal in your household, Mike?
Oh, yes. With three kids, it's always a big deal. So we're looking forward to that for sure. But what we're really looking forward to is next week, we're going to be out as a family in Chicago, and then we're going to be in South Bend. So we're going to have an opportunity to meet up with Matt, which we're super excited about.
Very cool. I didn't know you guys were going to get together. That's fabulous. Matt, I'm sure you're looking forward to that too.
Yeah, of course. It's a big Notre Dame USC game, so we'll assume that you are rooting for Notre Dame and not ask at all, and we'll smile about that. So, it's exciting. It's always a big game, and I'm really excited to meet Mike and his family.
Yeah, I went to UCLA, so you know what side I'm on.
I do.
Notre Dame. Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, Irish.
Indeed. You know what else is exciting about next week is it will be our episode 404.
Wow.
So we need your help, people. Send us links that are appropriate for a show not found kind of episode of This Week in Law. We definitely need to do something in honor of episode 404. We will record it next Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record all of our episodes of This Week in Law on Fridays at that time. You're welcome to join us live. We love it if you can. You would come on over to the Twit site at twit.tv to do that and click the link at the top that says watch live. And then you can join us live and you can also jump into chat at irc.twit.tv. But if that doesn't work in your schedule, never fear. You can always head on over to our show page at twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows going back to 2006 is there for your viewing and listening pleasure. In the beginning, we were merely audio, but we rapidly progressed into the video format that we all enjoy so much today. So go dig into our archives if you are so inclined. We've had lots of lawyers on over the years that may now be working at Bebe Choi's firm, people from Gunderson and Wilson, et cetera. Lots of wonderful, wonderful folks throughout the years. We're so glad and grateful that people are so generous with their time and come on our show to discuss these issues that we love to go deep on. We're so glad that you are generous with your time and join us as well. You should get in touch with us to let us know about your suggested 404 episode links and other things like other guests that you think we should invite on the show topics you think that we need to be paying attention to, email us, reach us on social media. Our email addresses are as follows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. And you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things work. Please do let us know what's on your mind. We're very, very grateful for your help with the show and grateful that you join us every week or that you've joined us this week. If it's your very first time listening to the show, we hope you'll come back. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much again, Mike. Great to see you.
Oh, it was great to be with both of you.
And Matt?
Yeah, great to see you guys and looking forward to the next show.
Matt Curtis, Mike Keyes, I want photos. I want selfies of you guys.
Oh, yes.
When you meet in meet space, something Mike and I have done, and Matt, you and I haven't managed to pull that off yet, but hopefully someday we will.
Yeah, I think that over the holiday break, I should be heading out your way, so we'll have to make it happen.
Good fun. All right. Well, enjoy that, and I will see you guys next week, and hopefully see a lot of you audience members next week on This Week in Law. Take care.